everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We begin with a study from Tohoku University in Japan. It's very simple. Taking good care of your teeth, according to them, may be linked to better brain health. According to the study published in the issue Neurology, the study found that gum disease and tooth loss were linked to brain shrinkage in the hippocampus, which plays an important role in memory and Alzheimer's disease. The study does not prove that gum disease or tooth loss causes Alzheimer's. It only shows an association. But still, it's important. I mean, we have a lot of gum disease in this country, and a lot of periodontal work is being done. So really take care of your teeth, all right, and gums. And just read some articles on holistic tooth care. For those who try to prevent cancer wherever possible, new information from the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, broccoli sprouts, like in a broccoli salad. You can sprout your own broccoli. It's easy to do. It takes about 8 days, and you get these very nutrient-rich sprouts. Very tasty, kind of tangy. But what's important is that, according to this study, if you have yourself a lot of broccoli, it's like in a broccoli salad, you activate a detoxification gene, and that can prevent cancer reoccurrence in survivors of head and neck cancer. Now, we also have a lot more neck and head and ear and jaw cancers because of the use of cell phones. I'll be continuing with my discussion on the dangers of cell phone either today or tomorrow. And keep in mind, with head and neck cancer, according to the study, they often clear patients of cancer only if it has some backup system to help, and broccoli sprout seems to be the thing that's making a difference. So what will it do for other cancers? We don't know. That wasn't tested, but for that it does. Now, from the Mayo Clinic comes a study about fluctuating levels of cholesterol and triglycerides is linked to an increased risk of dementia. That means you're kind of like on a seesaw. You're going up and down and up and down. And the more meat you have, the more dairy you have, the more saturated fats, the more cholesterol, the more triglycerides, the LDL cholesterols. And the oxidation of these fats ages you and can age also your brain. But older people who have this fluctuation of cholesterol and triglycerides have a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias compared to people who have steady levels. So 3 times a year, get a simple, inexpensive lipid profile and have these markers tested: homocysteine, C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, triglycerides, LDL cholesterol. Those are the ones that when they're elevated, there's a problem. And if they are elevated, not difficult to lower them. A B-complex will help do that. B12, folic acid, B1, B6 can make a difference. But you have to have it on a regular basis. All right? So total cholesterol, if it stays normal, that's a good thing. Also from the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom, a study links overuse of antibiotics with severe COVID side effects. Frequent and diverse use of antibiotics can be associated with developing more severe outcomes after COVID infection, including death. That's according to this study. The team, which also included researchers from the University of Oxford and Leeds, were the first to explore how the severity of COVID disease is affected by prior antibiotic use. What they found is patients with more frequent antibiotic exposure in the past 3 years were at higher odds of experiencing severe COVID outcome, including hospital admissions and 30-day death, meaning you die within 30 days after that, going in the hospital. And it's a whole range of antibiotics, and we just use too many antibiotics. And we frequently use antibiotics like for a cold or flu that has no bearing upon viruses. It's good for bacteria killing, but not viruses. And yet almost always people get a cold or flu, they take an antibiotic. That's not good, because the antibiotics also sterilize, kill off the good bacteria in your gut. And also there's an herb I'm sure many of you know about it or have tried it, Rhodiola rosea, R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A, R-O-S-E-A. And according to the Wenzhou Medical University in China, it has neuroprotective properties. So if you want to protect your brain, then have Rhodiola rosea in your diet. And this was published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine. And one other study today that is important, and all these come from the PubMed, is a lack of sleep found to lessen cognitive benefits of physical activity. So regular physical activity may protect against cognitive decline as we get older, but this protective effect may be diminished for people who are not getting enough sleep. So the study published in The Lancet, Healthy Longevity, looked at cognitive function over 10 years in 8,958 people, 50 and over, in England. The research team investigated how different combinations of sleep and physical activity might affect a person's cognitive function over time. They found that people who were more physically active but had not had a good night's sleep of at least 6 hours on average had faster cognitive decline overall. Now, there's a lot of things I've discussed of how you can have a better night's sleep. Make a list of the things you're stressed about. And the number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, list the things that are most problematic in your mind and say that tomorrow you're going to deal with these in that order. By writing it down, talking it out, you then calm the mind. Then don't eat any food within 4 hours of going to bed. Don't have any caffeine. Get rid of cell phones and electric digital appliances around your head within 6 feet. Make sure you have a dark room. And if not, get an iPad. These little soft, pillowy, cushiony things go over the eyes. And if there's noise, get yourself some earplugs. If you do that, you're far more likely to have good night's sleep. And you can take some theanine. Theanine is amino acid found in green tea. It's a calming herb. You can also take melatonin. Start with 1 milligram for a week and see. Time yourself. What time you go to bed, how many times you wake up, and your total night's sleep. And then if you don't get better, go to 2 milligrams. Graduate yourself up. All right? That's the latest on health and healing. And remember, anytime you want, go to YouTube Gary Nall and download Classrooms on the Air. Now, these are not controversial. They're not my investigative reporting pieces. They're just good, quality, science-based ways that we can live a longer and healthier and happier life. And I've done a whole series on dealing with stress and how not to become a victim of that stress, how to stay calm, how to be able to bring focus and attention to what you're doing so there's greater cognitive ability. So we all need sharper minds, especially when we see the consequences of a dumbed-down curriculum. And as a teacher at the academic level, at college and university for 45 years. That's a long career in teaching. College New Rochelle, Pratt Institute, Fairleigh Dickinson University, etc. I know that it's important, the mindset you take in. Do you really come to this class because you want to learn something? If you do, then that's going to benefit you. If you don't, then the likelihood is whatever you're taught, you're not going to remember and not be able to use. So what if we just applied that same principle to everything else in life? Bring a conscious awareness. Then there's an ease of learning, and the ease of applying what you've learned, and the ease of living, instead of the dis-ease that we have today that's so permeating our society. And every day at noon Eastern Standard Time, go to PRN.live, PRN, Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. Scroll down to the archives and scroll further to Gary Nall's show, and you'll be able to watch what I'm saying right now, and then our videos that we play also. All right, or go to the archives. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'm going to be presenting over the next month individuals who I've invited on this program to discuss or debate issues. Not all have responded. In fact, very few have. But therefore, I'm going to take segments in proper context, not edited, for you to be able to look for yourself. Now, it doesn't mean I agree or disagree in part or whole with anything these people are saying. I'm simply saying these are people who are saying something that maybe we should pay attention to. So listen to what they're saying, then say, I didn't realize that, or I disagree with them. Both are fine. We are a promoter of free speech, even free speech we don't like, because we have been locked out, closed down on every major form, and it's not a conspiracy theory, as mainstream media tries to laughingly joke about. No, there are now congressional testimonies on the record and also Freedom of Information Act showing that all of our social platforms, Facebook, Google, Twitter, all were controlled by the deep state, the CIA, the FBI, Homeland Security, and corporate interest. If they didn't like someone or what they were saying, they could cancel you. They could stop the algorithms. So even if you wrote an article, nobody's going to know it because there's not going to be any of your article promoted out there. Versus if you're someone they want to have in a position of power, oh, they'll promote you. And that's why you go to, let's say, a site I never go to. I tell people, walk away from Wikipedia. But unless you know the truth of something, you're not going to walk away from anything. You're not going to stop using their credit cards, buying their clothes, eating their food, watching their media, voting for them, because you're going to believe what the media tells you instead of realizing it's the media that are the propagandists, and they're merciless. So, good people have been canceled. Whistleblowers have been denied any virtue at all. They've been condemned universally, all of them, no exceptions. So we bring in all those whistleblowers. We expose the corruption in all of politics. Here's a lecture that we need to watch because it does some deep diving. This is for people in this audience who are not afraid of critical thinking. This is Susan Neiman. She is a leading feminist. She's very liberal. She's been a supporter of the Democratic Party. And she's being interviewed by one of the most critical thinkers in Great Britain, a Marxist, also very liberal, freedom of speech advocate, Brendan O'Neill. And their topic is, there's nothing left-wing about wokeness. Again, you decide if it's a value or not. Would you support what they're saying or not? Because you'll have a chance to challenge them, and all the other people have not been able to get on the show but would like to. But again, a lot of people won't come on this show. The reality is, they don't want to debate me. Fair enough. But let's then take when they've been given an opportunity on someone else's show, and then we'll hear what they have to say. All right? Give us a call later at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, because you're now given an opportunity to talk back, either in support or challenging them. All right? And it's a little longer clip than normal, because I wanted to go long enough into this clip so you really hear the essence of what they're saying and their arguments. And then I'll share my thoughts after you share yours of what their future is likely to be now that they've made these statements. Let's go to the clip.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Susan Neiman. Susan, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you on, and I want to talk to you primarily about your new book, which is called Left is Not Woke, which might just be one of my favorite book titles of recent years. I think the world has been waiting for a book explaining why what is referred to as wokeness or what is conceived of as wokeness is not left-wing, as some of us would have traditionally understood left-wing to mean. So I'm very interested in the ideas that you put forward in the book and in your takedown of woke.
It seemed like a book that needed to be written, which is why I threw away my plans to take a break last summer and wrote it.
Well, I'm very glad you did that, and I'm sure lots of readers of the book will be too. So where to start? I think probably the best place to start is by asking you to do something that I get asked all the time, and I do struggle a little bit, which is to define what we mean by woke. So you touch on the fact in your book and in the things you've written, we all know what woke used to mean. It's a term that comes largely from the African American community in the United States. It means being aware to social injustice. Stay woke, stay awake, stay alert is basically what it meant. But it's obviously become much more pejorative in recent years. I use it all the time. I probably overuse it to describe a culture that I understand and feel is problematic, but I'm conscious of the fact that people don't instantly recognize what we're talking about all the time. So just to kick off, how do you see woke? When you hear that word, what are you thinking about?
Well, when I first heard the word, I thought it was a great word. And what's wrong, as you've put it, with being awake to social injustice and trying to do something about it? But as the few years have gone by, I've come to think that it's a movement or a trend which indeed appeals to and is driven by emotions which were traditional to the left: concern for people who are marginalized and a determination to root out injustice, a desire to correct or at least to acknowledge the historical injustices. So all of that, I think, is quite confusing to those of us who are on the left. But what then has happened, it seems to me, is that it's fueled by a bunch of theoretical assumptions that are actually quite reactionary and have not been part of the traditional left at all. I deliberately, in writing this book, did not want to write another litany of woke excess. I could have done that very easily, and there's some books on the market that do it. The only time I use the word cancel culture is in the very first sentence, which says this is not a book about cancel culture. Okay, what I try to do in this book is to look at the theoretical, philosophical assumptions that are behind those excesses. And it should be said, I do talk a lot about philosophy. This is a book about for the general reader. And even for those woke activists who have never read a word of Michel Foucault or Carl Schmitt, those are assumptions that have gotten into the general culture. And I did provide a few examples of, mainstream media that thoughtlessly has taken over ideas like, we are fundamentally determined by what tribe we were born into. And that has become, you see that in, very standard mainstream publications like the New York Times all the time, or The Guardian, or, in other countries as well. And that is anathema to what it's always meant to be on the left. That was traditionally a very right-wing view, the idea that you're only really going to deeply connect with somebody from your tribe, and you therefore only have real obligations to people within your tribe. Whereas the left-wing standpoint was, our tribe can encompass the whole world. They're not determining identities. Of course, we're affected by the culture we grew up in and the histories of our ancestors, but they don't determine us. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one way in which I feel that the woke has diverged from the left. Another is in the confusion between justice and power. And once again, let's go back to the days before the liberal left began during the Enlightenment. If a peasant stole a prince's deer, he could be hanged. And that was simply the way the world is, because you didn't have the idea there was one law that applied to everyone just in virtue of their being human. If the prince took the peasant's daughter, that was also part of the way the world was. We failed to appreciate how radical that position is because we've been living with it for a good 200 or 300 years. Of course, it gets violated. I mean, we know, plenty of instances in which justice gets confused with power, or indeed when power claims are disguised by claims about justice. I think the Iraq war is a great example. And it's still amusing that there are Europeans who really believe that the U.S. went to war in Iraq because they wanted to establish democracy, where those of us who were looking a little more closely saw this was actually not what they were doing at all. The theorists who the woke read and depend on are people like Foucault, like Schmitt, who don't recognize a real distinction between justice and power. They think it's all hype. And the third way in which I think that the woke diverges from the left is its despair, really, or cynicism, depending on the mood, about the possibility of making progress. Now, it's certainly true that there are people, you know, people who are woke activists want to make progress. But if you don't actually acknowledge that progress has been made in the past, if you say things like, you know, we're just as racist as we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, or the patriarchy has, you know, ruined women's lives forever and any improvement is basically just a sham. And from you hear people saying things like that all the time, then you're not going to believe that human beings working together can actually make progress. I hope that's a decent definition of the distinction between woke and left. I mean, many of us, and this was the reason that I wrote the book, many of us spend time over coffee, over beer, late at night, telling stories of one piece of woke excess or another. And we could spend the entire conversation doing that. But it didn't seem fruitful to me. It seemed much more important right now to get behind the ideas that are fueling woke excess.
Yeah. And it's like in the 80s, people used to have discussions all the time about political correctness gone mad. And they would pick the most extreme examples, like, you know, bar black sheep being banned in schools because it's racist. And what they should have been doing, of course, is looking at the cultural and political shifts that underpinned some of these changes that were referred to as political correctness. And I think that you're right. There is a similar danger in relation to wokeness where we sit around lamenting the extreme manifestations of it rather than thinking about the philosophical underpinnings of the shift that has taken place on the left. I think what's really valuable about your book, you say there that it's a philosophical book, and it is. You are, of course, a world-renowned moral philosopher. That's an important thing for people to bear in mind. The book is also incredibly accessible and very readable, and I think it's brilliant both for someone who wants an introduction to what wokeness means and also someone who wants a deeper understanding of some of the trends and developments behind it. You've just given an outline there of what are essentially the three blocks in your book. So the shift from universalism to tribalism amongst the left, their confusions over justice and power and how they're really wrong on that, and also their cynicism, their doom-mongering, their sense of fatalism. Those are your three ways in which you explain that what is currently looked upon as woke is not left as it would traditionally have been understood. That's very useful because I want to ask you about all three of those and just get a bit more of a sense of why you thought they were important. So let's kick off with the universalism stuff. You really do focus a lot on the universalism question at the start of the book. And it is very striking that there has been this shift on the left from universalism to particularism, from the idea that we might be bound by our beliefs or our convictions to this idea that we're more bound by our cultural heritage or our skin color or our gender or our sex. I remember I was on BBC TV here with Robin DiAngelo, the author of White Fragility, and she was talking about, you know, she and I as white people and why we could never understand black people. And I was saying, but, you know, the arguments that were traditionally made by progressives is that whites and blacks could absolutely bind together over class politics, over workplace struggles, over a view of society that might be better than the one we currently live in. And it seemed so alien to her that I was saying these things that go beyond skin color. So just explain to us why you think that's important.
Well, the interesting thing with Robin DiAngelo, of course, in the 19th century, neither the Irish nor the Jews nor the Italians were considered to be white. Yeah. So these are really very fluid categories. I mean, yeah. that's one problem with that kind of essentialism. What's increasingly been clear to me is that the problem with woke identitarianism, which is really, you know, just the mirror image, frankly, of white identitarianism, is the reduction of the many identities that we all have to two. And I think anybody who thinks about this for a minute will realize that they have a whole bunch of identities that are incredibly important to them, but at different times. I mean, I don't even always, I am a woman. I've never considered myself anything other than a woman, but it's only in certain situations that that's been, you know, that's the identity that I focus on. I'm also a mother, you know, which when my kids were little was a primary component of my identity. Less so now. People identify deeply with their political convictions, sometimes with their professions, with all kinds of things. But what we're now told to do is to reduce all of these complex and sometimes shifting identities to two. And they're actually the two that we have the least control over. And the ones that are, you know, therefore not a product of agency. They're not identities that we choose. They're identities that are forced onto us at birth. You know, complicate, let's leave the question of gender, you know, whether gender is forced on you at birth or not. It's for most people, it is. For some people, it's not. And in so doing, it takes agency and choice out of the equation of who we are. But, you know, the tendency of people now among the woke to make an argument by saying, I as a woman, you know, I as a black man, I as a queer person, you know, as if that were all the I was. And, you know, that serves instead of an argument. And it's a very troubling development.
I think that's right. And I sometimes have the same instinct as you to wish that things were a bit more individualist in the traditional liberal, rugged individual sense, even though I am not necessarily an individualist, politically speaking. But because one thing I found is that in left-wing identitarian politics, there's often an unconfident contingent declaration of identity. So if you look at the phrase, I identify as, for example, whereas in the past, people would have said, I am a shoemaker, I am a Roman Catholic, I am a woman. There was a sense of confidence, a sense of being in the world, present in the world, relating to other people. Whereas now it's much more, I identify as, and sometimes it's, I identify as this for now, but I don't quite know what I'm going to be in 6 weeks' time. My gender might change. My race might change. If you're Rachel Dolezal, for example, the identity politics can seem quite strident and sometimes even quite unforgiving. And that's where I do think cancel culture comes into it. They want to wipe aside certain forms of criticism. But that stridency disguises a crisis of identity. So you go looking for other ones and sometimes just inventing them from pure cloth or relying upon your given natural identity rather than one that you foster yourself in a meaningful way.
I think that's a very good point. And you're pointing to a contradiction because it goes both ways. It's often a quite incoherent standpoint to identity. On the one hand, your identity is fixed. And so Rachel Dolezal, because she wasn't born black, even though, you know, she grew up around a largely black family and identified that way, you know, was hounded out of her job because she was, you know, not conforming to this absolutely essentialist identity. Whereas, you know, we have the whole transgender debate, which, you know, if you can decide that you're born gender identity is not your real one. And anyone who even raises questions about that is, you know, transphobic. It seems that it ought to, you know, cases like Rachel Dolezal's, and there have been a couple of other ones, you know, ought to be greeted with at least a little more ambiguity and ambivalence than they were. So I think you're pointing to a real contradiction. On the other hand, we have cases of people who are uncertain about their identity and want the freedom to acknowledge it, or rather to change their birth-given identity. But in other cases, you know, what you are at birth essentially determines your entire set of attitudes towards the world. And people who, you know, I certainly have friends of color who don't feel that their entire identity is being determined by their skin color and the way that they might be perceived on the street, and do not want to take part in Robin DiAngelo's style anti-racism. And they then, it's really quite interesting, they get called black conservatives, even though their politics might, I mean, I don't think their politics are conservative at all. It's, you know, quite, you know, runs the gamut in the some of the people I'm thinking of, from, you know, left-leaning liberal to socialist. But if they break now with the race, what's considered to be correct racial politics, they're stamped as conservative. And I have friends. These were both white friends who told me, you know, before I published the book, for God's sake, don't write a book with the word woke in the title. It will be used by the right. And, you know, I kind of agree with your arguments, but you will be giving aid and comfort to Ron DeSantis or Rishi Sunak or whoever uses woke as a way to attack any attempt to come up with, you know, different ways of looking at history, different ways of seeking racial or gender justice. And I thought about it. I looked for other titles, and then I decided, no, actually, I'm staying with this. This is we all know what we're talking about. So far, I have not been instrumentalized by the right. The worst I've seen is a comment on a right-wing blog saying something like, well, you have to wade through a lot of leftist bullshit to get there, but she does have a few good ideas. This is not actually being instrumentalized.
Okay, that was the first 20 minutes of a longer clip. And what's important, if you just joined us, is I'm playing clips from people who I've invited on the program to have discussions, civil discussions on important issues. And this is an issue about, for those who have a difference of opinion, should they have a right to share that opinion? Because there's a growing divide in the United States, and it's surprising for those of us who champion freedom of speech and human rights of all people and have fought that battle. It's disappointing to see that much of the liberal community has been corporatized, like much, if not most, of the Republican community has been commodified, commercialized, and it's depersonalized. They don't care what bureaucracies do to us. They don't care what their laws do to us. And they just want to keep in power, and they've been successful. But now they've overplayed their hand. What some people would have tolerated, after all, for those of us who supported the gay movement, for women to declare if they choose that they are attracted to women, okay. As a lesbian, that doesn't change who they are as a human being and what they can contribute to society. That just means they have a different perspective. It's their business. They have a right to that. A gay man, the same way. And a trans person, the same way. So if you're a man wanting to associate or identify as a woman, that's your right. and people should at least respect to make sure that none of your rights are diminished. Where the rub is on children. And I do not believe that up to this point we've had an intelligent discussion with people who are not political, but rather looking at what the consequence would be if we just let children act out. There was a time when I was growing up that I wanted to be a fireman, then I wanted to be a policeman, and then I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to be all these different things. And you grow through it. I wanted to be a baseball player because we had our heroes. So shouldn't we allow children to have at least the time and the non-toxic approach of allowing people to see where they fit? Now, once they become an adult and they see that they don't fit, then they have a right to transition. I just wish that the pro-transition community would at least be open to all the science, and there's a lot of science, of what happens when you start taking hormone-blocking agents and when you're going to a radical step. Shouldn't you go through normal transition steps? Because here's what no one is showing you, but it's all over the internet. People who felt that their child was one way and helped them get transitioned early in life and then found out it was a mistake. How do you undo that mistake? And also, what about the adults that have transitioned back? It's not that there's one or two, there's a lot. Shouldn't their voices be heard? Shouldn't we have an open forum where every person has opportunities to share their points of view so that anyone else wanting to make a decision at least is not making it out of some ideology? Our whole society today is influenced by ideologies. I'll give you an example. They took the world's greatest boxing woman, and she's a legend. I'll bet not a single person in this audience knows who she is. If you think you do, email me or call in at 888-874-4888. But she never lost a fight, and almost no fight ever went more than a few rounds. She won every title. She then unbeaten, and then she was a kickboxer, and she won every title. So unquestionably, she was the greatest female boxer in history. They wanted to see how she would do against a male, biological male. And so they put not a top contender, not even a ranked boxer. I mean, he wouldn't be in the top 5,000 men boxers. And he was a little guy. She dwarfed over. She was much larger than him. And he just knocked her out. He just boom, boom, boom. It was over. You take then the largest woman, a power lifter, and she's huge muscle, probably the strongest woman in America. And then a guy identifies as a female, goes in there and easily beats that record, easily beats it. And now he transitions back, but he's got the world record. And you take the fastest athlete woman ever. She couldn't be in the top 1,000 men athletes. When I was competing in New York City and around the United States, around the world, we had a women's, international competition in the World Games, the men's. I mean, you would have half the men beat the fastest woman. And I raced against some of the fastest, in fact, the fastest woman. She was way behind. So is it fair? And also, how about mixed martial arts? That's brutal to see, but I wanted to see it for myself, so it's up on tape. So they took the best female mixed martial arts, and one guy gets in, he's not ranked, and he put these women in the hospital, three of them. Now, whether they're going to suffer permanent brain damage, that should never have happened. That fight should never have been allowed. And then you take, did you ever notice, go back, those of you who, like myself, are real athletes, and not just weekend athletes, we're competitive, and you look at the records for men and women, they were stationary for almost 40 years. Same way in baseball. You realize it was, over 70 years or more before someone broke Babe Ruth's record, Roger Maris. But then how quickly did they break Roger Maris' record? Just boom, 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 all of a sudden. All these guys, Sammy Sosa and Barry Bonds and McGuire, etc. Whole group of them. How'd that happen? Well, people said it was anabolic steroids. And how did Johnson, the Canadian runner, suddenly become the fastest guy in the world and really smash the record twice in one day? Turns out it was anabolic steroids. Same way with the woman, top Olympian. She was congratulated, and then they found out she'd been taking the hormone. She went to prison. So how is it fair for those who took anabolic steroids to hold a record? Every single person that beat Roger Maris's record should have had tests taken before and after, and to see were they using steroids, because you can't suddenly have 70 years of tens of thousands of athletes can't come close to it, and suddenly a whole group just exceeds it by a huge margin. That's not going to happen unless people were on these hormones. So we don't allow enhancement hormones or anything else in any sport. If a racehorse does it, we cancel it. We've had winners, Kentucky Derby and others. They lost because they were drugged. So then why not do this? Why have a trans a biological man who now associates as a woman? Fine, no problem. But now they're breaking all the records of all women. How does that impact women who spent their entire lives up to that point competing and finally getting to where they have a chance to win? And now there's a record set that's so far ahead, it'll never be broken by any woman in sports. Is that fair? I'll tell you what is fair and reasonable and non-political is to have women's sports, men's sports, and trans sports have a league, official league. So a trans man and a trans woman can compete against other trans men and other trans women. That way, if you win against others, good for you. You know, then you earn that. But I am opposed to biological men identifying as women and then beating every woman in the world in every competition. Cycling, a man beat it. Swimming, racing, wrestling, weightlifting, boxing, martial arts. When does it stop? Because people want this as a political agenda? No, let's be human, let's be realistic. And where's the women's movement supporting women? And also, for those in the movement who are the more radicalized, and you're attacking lesbians now because you say that if you're a man who wants to be a woman, then and you say you're identifying as a woman, and now that you want to date a lesbian, and the lesbian says, no, thank you. Now you're saying she's transphobic. No, she's identifying her needs, and you cannot say that your needs for her to accept, and she rejects it, makes her somehow less than a human being. And by the way, when you open that door, you don't have any idea what's going to come back through at you. But it's coming, all right? I think we're being very immature in how we're approaching so many of these topics. It's so political. Everything is political today. So I'm going to be having people on, and whether you agree or disagree with them, and that's what I want to know now. What did you learn from this talk? Anything? Again, I'm not saying I invite these people on because I agree with them. I think that they're talking about things that are very important, all right? And keep this in mind. This is just today from Postmillennial, quote, trans kids prescribe more antipsychotic meds after beginning gender transition than before study. And this is the title of the study. Psychotropic medication increased following gender-affirming pharmacological initiation, end quote. All right, this was published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine and examined the Department of Defense medical records of 3,754 trans-identified adolescents. Do you have the science that proves that taking a hormone therapy for the rest of your life will not adversely affect you? There are no such studies. So how can you say that there's no problem when the science doesn't support the safety? Even if the ethics are fine, even if you say good, even if we all agree, go for it. Well, what about the side effects? Does that not count? It sure does. So I say, let's slow all this down. Let's stop with all the attacking people using words. Because once you can control words, you control language. When you control language, you can impel speech. When you can impel speech, you codify it in laws. When you can codify it into a law, as they're doing in other countries right now as we speak, then you can make it against the law to disagree with you. If you say, you didn't give me the right pronoun, and now you are reported, you can go to jail. Canada just passed such a law, and there's a law being passed right now in the Senate, which has already been passed their House almost unanimously in Ireland. My goodness, that is just bad to the bone. All right? I'm just asking people to think before they engage. Do the homework. All right? 888-874-4888 is our number. I'd like to hear from you. And also, I want to mention that we're going to pull up a clip. I have this coming Sunday at 1 o'clock, the world premiere. Only one time it's going to show. So all over the world, you can watch it because we're going to Zoom it. Manufacturing Madness. If you're a person that knows anyone who's been impacted by the psychiatric and psychological communities, Big Pharma, this has got the world's leading experts. I mean the top of the top. One of the directors of the psychiatric Bible, the Diagnosing Statistical Manual number 5, I filmed him. It took me 5 years to get him to agree, but he agreed because he's seeing how bad it's gone. I led a demonstration. You're going to be able to see that demonstration. There were thousands of us across from the Javits Center where the World Congress in Psychiatry was being held. You see, I'm out there interviewing psychiatrists. Can you tell me what symptoms you look for in a person who has any psychiatric disorder, depression, anxiety, etc.? Well, there are no blood markers. It's all subjective. Well, it's all subjective. Then why not give them a sugar pill, placebo? Because what you're giving them, take a look at this. The number one side effect for depression is depression. So you're giving them medication that causes the very condition that they're trying to avoid. Anxiety, the same thing. Suicide. So this really opens up the entire field of psychiatry as a fraud. A fraud. The fact that we have a consensus, in fact, that the psychiatrist can control a person's life, can have you committed, doesn't mean it's legitimate. It's all, as you will hear, a fraud. And its whole history has been a fraud. And we show you, and I want to thank Roland Marconi and Valerie Van Cleve, the outstanding post-production after the filming, editing. We show you the entire history of psychiatry, all the insane asylums, etc. If you want to join me at 1 o'clock for this, it's going to be a short webinar. It'll be 3 hours. Call this number, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Or you can go right online and subscribe. But don't get to Saturday and then say, oh, I can't get in, because we've gotten as wide a bandwidth as we can get. Don't wait, or you won't be able to see it. And also, is Luann on the line? No? I thought someone
called. Yes, Luann is on.
Hi, let's go over and say hello, Luann, and I'd like to hear from you. We're laying out a lot of information for you. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. Hi, everyone. Well, I am filling up for our next retreat. Very exciting people that are calling to come down. So refreshing, Gary, to hear these people in your audience who are upbeat, who are excited about the potential of what we can be in spite of all this negativity that we seem to be surrounded by. I have some people who are coming back again for a second time. I have other people that are coming down for the first time who have been saving up and are just raring to go. So if anyone is interested, I still have some spots open. Do give me a call. It's a terrific opportunity. It couldn't be life-changing if you allow it to be. We're going to have drumming circles. We're going to have art classes, and they're just a ton of fun. We have our saltwater pool. We have swimming exercises, pool exercises. We have a full gym. We have yoga every day, meditation. We have all our beautiful animals and our birds roaming the property. We have the best meditation hut ever. So it's going to be a wonderful time, and it's going to be beautiful weather. So if anyone's interested, come on down, give me a call. I'm at 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. Give me a call, and I'll be happy to speak with you.
Good. So now I'm going to ask our studio in New York, do we have anyone calling in to share their opinions?
Not on topic, Gary.
Not on topic. Okay. Health officials squirm with more published deaths coming out on a daily basis. The final retort of "you cannot prove the vaccine caused the death," end quote, has just been blown out of the water. A Hushler and associate scientist have published the largest accumulation of autopsy results in deaths after COVID-19 vaccination. From a total of 325 cases, independent review found the COVID-19 vaccine was the cause of death in 73.9%. The vast majority had the cardiovascular system as the single fatal organ system injury in the body, meaning they had heart conditions like myocarditis. Now, also, there have been over 1,000 athletes, top athletes, who have died after the vaccines. Also, McCullough evidently had a conversation with the actor who has not discussed in any detail and has said that he wants him to come out. So I'm assuming that if that's the case, that he's going to talk about this came after the vaccines. Okay. Also, there's a brand new video out about how the big people in the planet, like the World Economic Forum, plan for a global CBDC, and that was just released. This means a cashless society. It's already being implemented, and they're going to try to push it down Americans' throat. Will they succeed? Well, we'll see. Also, there's been a whole effort, as many of you know, to try to sanction Russia and other countries into oblivion. Here's what RT just shared, quote, "Russia's $75 trillion in resources, why sanctions are impossible." This is something you won't hear in the mainstream media. Quote, "The country with the largest mineral reserves in the world, Russia, is the second top exporter of rare earth minerals. Its natural resources are estimated at tens of trillions of dollars. It has abundant supplies of oil, natural gas, timber, and valuable minerals like copper, diamonds, lead, zinc, nickel, tin, mercury, gold, and silver, bauxite. Most of these resources are located in Siberia and the Far East. Russia's mining industry, which is the country's second largest after oil and gas, accounts for a significant share of its gross domestic product and exports. The country is among the top three producers of mineral commodities such as platinum, gold, and iron ore. It also is the world's largest producer of diamonds and palladium. The Ural Mountains have vast amounts of minerals, while most deposits of coal, oil, gas, and timber are located in Siberia. Russia is the world's fifth largest producer of coal, with reserves of about 175 billion tons. Most of those mines are in Siberia and the Urals. The Russian timber industry, which is worth about $20 billion every year, is also a significant economic contributor to Russia's economy. The country's fishing industry is the fourth largest in the world. The value of Russia's resources is huge, and according to statistics, $75 trillion. In comparison, the United States' natural resources are worth about half that, around 40 to 45 trillion, and China's is at 23 trillion. And by the way, this is aside from the article, but Russia has the largest amount of organic farmland in the world. In fact, it's so large that they don't use GMO crops. They're opposed to that, and synthetic pesticides. They have a huge audience there, about 135 million people. When you consider Russia's size and you consider they have all these resources, every time you put a sanction on them, they just go ahead and create from scratch that industry. When Poland was no longer shipping them apples, for example, they just started growing apple orchards, but on a huge scale, larger than any other apple orchards in the world. In fact, if you took just the organic farmland, it would cover most of the United States. So exactly how are these best and brightest in the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House going to cause Russia to collapse, its population to revolt because it's standing in line eating 100 calories a day? No, they're prospering. Their ruble value has increased. They have unlimited amounts of resources. So wrong way to approach that topic. And yet that's typical. But you would not have known this if you're the average person. Also, for all the people living in Canada, as of this morning, 83 Canadian churches, mainly Catholic churches, have been vandalized or burned to the ground just in the last 30 days. If you have more information on this, on who's doing this vandalizing and what the government's doing to stop it, this is an awful lot of churches burned down in the last 30 days. And also, I'm going to be doing some videos later this week and continuing with the latest on 5G and beyond on tomorrow's program. And we have a lot more coming at you. Oh, and by the way, shout out to Mitch, Mitch out there, because what we're seeing is a lot of whistleblowers are not given the credit that they deserve. For example, Kit Clarenberg of the Gray Zone and the other people associated with the Gray Zone, they're giving us information that is exposing government and corporate malfeasance. This is the latest. Quote, leaked documents reveal Reuters help overthrow Egyptian democracy. Quote, Reuters served as a channel for the UK Foreign Office to covertly fund an Egyptian outlet that clamored for the overthrow of the country's first democratically elected leader, leaked documents show. The July 3rd marks the 10th anniversary of Egyptian Army Chief General Fatah Sisi, a violent seizure of power in Cairo, the first democratically elected leader in 5,000 years of Egyptian history. Mohamed Morsi was swept from office. His supporters were massacred by the hundreds, and he ultimately died in prison. The U.S. and U.K. support Sisi quickly reversed any tentative democratic gains made during the country's brief, difficult transition from the rule of longtime Western-backed autocrat Mubarak. In the decades since this coup, his government has systematically crushed opposition to his rule. Political parties and critical media have been banned en masse, activist journalists and civil society actors harassed, disappeared, and tortured in jail, and prison transformed into hotbeds of systemic sexual violence and other horrific abuse. It is estimated that half of Egypt's 120,000 inmate population are currently incarcerated for political reasons. Okay, and behind all this, British spies. And behind them, Reuters. So we want to thank the Gray Zone, and in this case, Kit Clarenberg, for doing original investigation and telling us the truth. At least now we have a more honest and objective perspective of what happened to democracy in Egypt. That's it for today. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's stay tuned for Utrecht Leads.